This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Elvira Green's life has had a few twists of what some might call fate, and perhaps none was more profound than the one that propelled her to a long career as an operatic singer. It was 1969. Elvira Green was a budding singer in New York. Her college voice teacher took her to visit the Metropolitan Opera, and there in the hallway was the director of the chorus. One impromptu audition later, and Elvira had a spot in one of the most storied opera houses in the world. Elvira Green eventually became a principal artist at the Met and has traveled the world several times over to perform what has become her signature role as Mariah in the Gershwin opera Porgy and Bess. Today, Elvira Green passes on her passion for music as an artist in residence at her alma mater, North Carolina Central University in Durham, and she joins me now on The State of Things. Elvira Green, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for asking.
Tell us about, you grew up in a musical household, didn't you?
Yes, my grandparents were musicians. My grandfather taught the solfège. We all sang in church choirs from tiny tots until the present day. But it was a musical family. My mother played the violin. My father was a pianist. All of my grandparents' 16 grandchildren took piano.
Oh, and you grew up in Greensboro?
We grew up in Warren County, in the northeast, just 7 miles short of the Virginia line, in a little hamlet called Macon.
And then you spent a fair amount of time in Guilford County?
Yes, when we became teenagers, my other cousins had gone north, as we say, and we had an aunt and uncle living in Greensboro, and they said to my mother, we're going to come take your children because they need a little culture.
Which you were going to get there in Guilford. Well, when did your formal music education start, would you say?
I started my first piano lessons at 6 years old. My formal music, as far as I can remember, began really then. Mm-hmm. I always took piano from that point, and so that by the time I arrived at my alma mater, North Carolina Central, I was playing Chopin and Mozart and all those wonderful composers.
And what was your vision for yourself when you went to Central?
My father was a concert pianist, and I could see nothing but 88 keys.
I see. So that's what you thought you were going to do.
Yes, until Africa Hayes came, the daughter of Roland Hayes came to North Carolina Central my junior year and said to me, why aren't you singing? And I thought, okay, I hadn't thought about it. I want to be what my father was. She then insisted that I study some of the operatic repertoire, and that's what started that.
Why did she think you should be a singer?
I guess she heard something in the voice. You know, those high sopranos who become teachers can hear something in other people's voices that we mezzos don't hear. And she must have heard something and said to me, you need to really consider studying voice. We had always sung in our choirs, as I mentioned earlier. And I was then singing in North Carolina College's concert choir.
So she could hear a little bit of that. What was your sense of opera? Obviously, you'd been come in contact with the music if you're studying classical music, some of it.
One of the things that we did every Saturday from the moment we arrived in Greensboro as teenagers was sit in my uncle's drugstore and listen to opera from the Met. So from my teenage days, that's where the opera came into our family.
So you already had an appreciation for it, but hadn't quite imagined yourself singing opera.
Absolutely not. I could go to the store or order the score and play it because then piano was my thing. So I would learn the entire operatic roles, the scores, by playing the whole opera.
What happens then once you make a change in direction like that? You're already in college. What's that transition like into voice?
Haven't sung so much all during my growing up days, I will say. It was simply then a matter of understanding the process by which technique works. Mm-hmm. One needed to establish that component so that one could be singing to whatever a ripe old age is going to be.
Well, that's I mean, I think that brings us to this interesting conversation about technique and formal training and understanding the process and the foundation versus a kind of natural talent. You do it and you do it well. The idea of doing it well, mm-hmm. having some talent and having some experience is a good thing. Then going back and saying, well, what is it I was doing that made it so good? I guess that's what you're saying, is understanding the foundations.
It really is understanding the foundation, and that comes from being fortunate enough, I would think, to have the teacher who helps you to understand the patience it takes for those little muscles there to grow and the memory to accept what is right. There were times that I knew I was making sounds that didn't make me feel good. I could make them, but I would say, but that doesn't make me feel good. So having the good fortune of good technique and a good teacher who could teach that was so very important in helping me to sustain myself as a singer who sang opera.
And who was that teacher?
That teacher started with Africa Hayes, mm-hmm. The daughter of Roland Hayes, the renowned tenor from back in the day. And then in New York, I met Lola Wilson Hayes and continued working with her on recital repertoire, which is another aspect that I'm really happy that I was introduced to, because that has been a mainstay as well as opera. And then rejoined with Africa, and the Met experience is something that I'm sure we'll talk about later. But then my final teacher, who really, really put that all together and had me to understand that singing is a feeling nature. The audience responds to what they hear in a positive way because you feel right about it. So that was Mayan Bishop, with whom I still once a year go to New York and sing a note or two.
Today we're meeting on The State of Things with the wonderful opera singer Elvira Green, and that conversation happening right here on The State of Things. That brings the education full circle when you talk about feeling, doesn't it? I mean, you do really well, you sing in the choir, you sound great, everybody loves you. Then you learn how to do it. You get those uncomfortable notes, things that don't sound as great to you, but are at least hard to achieve. And then ultimately, then you have to put the feeling back into it. Don't lose that part.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. After the intellect of the words and the notes and putting it in the head, then you have to, as I say to my young students these days, you have to take it from your head and put it in your heart. But you take with that all that technical information. And when you've sung a song and you look at yourself in the mirror and you feel good about what's looking back at you, you know you have felt good about the technique.
And that means understanding the words, the context, the story. How long do you spend just living with the story before you even begin to think about the music?
I always say, and because I had this incredible coach, Sylvia Olden Lee, who would say to me, if you can't tell me what the words mean, then you can't express how they make you feel. So if I had an aria or two or even a role to work with her, I would have to know in whatever language it happened to have been, every single word, not just, you know, reading it by IPA or but to really know, have the muscle memory, accept what is this story about? What is the line that follows another line and how does it connect? In other words, how did you get here? Where are you going? Now you can tell me what you're doing here.
And understanding the context as well. I mean, as you say, it's in a foreign language, sometimes written a couple of hundred years ago. And so you have to understand the historical context, and a little bit about it. I've always marveled at this with opera singers or anyone who sings not in their native tongue. Mm-hmm. The ability to give the right emphasis to those words in a way a native singer would and still provoke in me or evoke from me the same emotion.
I have been among the group of fortunate people who always loved languages, so that my years at the Met were spent with coaches in all the languages in which we sang, both in as the ensemble and then as a principal. So I learned, for instance, when we sang Boris Godunov in Russian and I was doing The Innkeeper, I knew every word that I was singing.
And what it meant. Then how does the music, are you listening to the music at the same time, or do you really just focus on the libretto and then get to the...
I do take the words off the page. I have to live with the page. I have to live with the story. I have to have it in my mind's eye, as I say. Because music to me followed the pattern of the words. And by being able to play the piano, then I could go and play everything and then sing my part.
Well, we will find out how you came to have this marvelous career in opera. From North Carolina, Elvira Green, formerly of the Metropolitan Opera in New York, now artist in residence at her alma mater, North Carolina Central. We'll continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest, mezzo-soprano Elvira Green. She sang for the Metropolitan Opera in New York, off and on for nearly three decades. She is now artist in residence at North Carolina Central University's Music Department. So let's talk about your transition. You talked about making the switch from piano to voice at North Carolina Central. Mm-hmm. What were your plans after that? What did you want to do once you left North Carolina Central?
Oh, dear. I think musicians never stop being musicians. And so I'm going to continue teaching, coaching, counseling my summer opera programs with young people, preteens and young teens, and traveling now as a tourist.
Well, I've taken you now to the present, but I want to take you back to that moment when you graduated from North Carolina Central. I think you'd planned to go to Washington, D.C., right?
Yes, my plan was to go to study with Todd Duncan because by that time, Africa Hayes had convinced me that I should go ahead and get serious about the singing. So I went to D.C., as we say, and got in touch with Mr. Duncan, and I was so excited to meet him and start my lessons. And on our first meeting, he said, well, I don't generally take people that are not recommended to me. So I called my mom and said, can you come and get me with my sewing machine and my Groves dictionary my father had given me for graduation? And we came back to Greensboro. We regrouped. And then I went to New York in the 1st of July of whatever that year was, and reconnected with Africa Hayes, and then that's when all of that started.
What were you doing then? Were you working at all? Did you find any kind of work?
Yes, of course. You know, in this country, you don't work only because you don't want to work. So I found a 5 and 10 cent department store, and I went to work there. The wonderful thing about being there was the proprietor was French, and because French was the language that I loved, I spent a year speaking French in D.C.
Wow.
But because I also had access to piano, I kept my piano going, and of course that meant I kept my opera scores playing. But I knew that I was not going to then make Washington, D.C. my home because one thing I knew I needed was a teacher.
So you go to New York, you're taking some instruction, and you visit the Met, but you're not on stage at the moment. Tell us about that fortuitous trip
yes.
to the Met.
Yes. Well, Africa Hayes, we had reconnected in New York, and she called me one day and said, come go with me to the Metropolitan to meet my godfather, who was Francis Robinson. So we walked into the inner sanctums, as they say, of the Met, and this gentleman walks down the hall and he says, Elfrica, hello, how are you? And who is that you have there? And his very heavy Austrian accent. And she says, oh, it's a student of mine. Does she sing? Yes, she does. Let me hear her sing something. So I sang the aria from La Favorita. And when I finished, he said, oh, it's a beautiful voice, but it's all over the place.
But there you're just standing there like in the middle of a hallway.
Absolutely. Because even at that point, though I had learned a number of arias, I wasn't afraid or excited, or I was at the Met, but I had gone with my teacher to meet her, mentor. And so after that, about, maybe a couple of months, I think it was later, I get this phone call and it says, we would like you to come and sing in the extra chorus at the Metropolitan Opera. And so I went and did 5 years off and on of extra chorus work, and then did the I do's, as we say, will you marry me? Yes, I will. And ended up in Europe on a government tour, a government sponsored tour.
Well, I do's with whom? Are you signing up with the Met? Does this mean?
No, I got married.
Oh, really? Like in real life, you got married?
In real life.
That I do. I get it.
So my husband and I, he was a baritone, and we were living in Germany and traveling, doing the government-sponsored tour with Anne Brown and all those wonderful people. And then I get this call from the Metropolitan Opera. When it was October, when are you coming back to New York? I said, well, we plan to come in February. Well, good. Can we send you music? We want you to cover one of the nieces in La Pericole. And I thought, oh, okay. So then I came back. We came back in February of whatever year that was. I'm never good with years. but I went directly to the Metropolitan, and then instead of being the contralto in the extra chorus, I mean the second soprano in the extra chorus, I accepted the contralto, the second alto parts in the regular chorus, and that's where I was for 8 years. Meanwhile, covering and performing what they call the small roles. That was before the Young Artist Program at the Met. So the chorus people were given, you know, the one lines, the five lines, the five pages, and things of that nature.
And that's the difference. And with the extra chorus, what were you doing there? How's that different?
The extra chorus, just when they needed a large chorus in operas, for instance, like Aida, or Meistersinger, or Cavan Pagh, they used extra chorus people. They needed like 110 people on stage. So those were the operas that I performed as extra chorus. In the regular chorus, you are there the entire season learning 15 operas.
Well, so this is somewhere around the early 70s.
This is around the early 70s, yes. I can say that that was until 1975. And then I began to be offered more, I would call, supporting parts that ended up being more than five pages, sometimes up to 30 pages. And then I left the Met in 78.
Well, before we get to that point, though, I want to take a look at the landscape at that time. We're talking about late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. You're embarking on a career as an opera singer. You're an African-American woman. Mm-hmm. What was the landscape like? What was your sense of the roles for Africa, or the openness of the opera community to African-Americans, male or female?
It's amazing that you asked that question. There were three African-American women in the Metropolitan Opera Chorus, no African-American men at that time. Eleanor Hopper was the first woman invited to join the Met Chorus permanently. Nadine Brewer was the second, and Elvira Green was the third. And so we did a lot of civil work, as we call it, to get people to understand you want an audience, you want a diverse audience. They have to see diversity on the stage, whether it's chorus, whether it's the principal artists. I mean, yes, the principals were there because there was Leontine Price and Robert McFerrin and people of that nature, but in the ensemble. So we worked really hard for that. But I have to say, being in that environment was not so much, oh, well, I'm African-American, and three of us in a company of 80, which was the maximum number of the course, because the relationship was so important and so congenial, because we were all there working hard. You know, when the curtain comes up and the lights come up and you're in costume and makeup, that's for your audience. The work that's done is really the backbone of why we were all there doing that. So,
what about the Met itself, though? I mean, I can understand that from the artistic standpoint, the idea that just making the work great is enough to sell this opera and to make it the beautiful, the beautiful thing that it should be. But is there a kind of cultural resistance, or did it take time for the Met to figure out how it was going to embody and put in action some of the suggestions that you make? I mean, there are these kind of cultural, or were there cultural barriers to actually changing?
I think when they realized, we call it the industry, they realized that in order to maintain certain status, whatever that was, they had to hire more African-American singers. The only time we felt the resistance was when the three of us stepped out, as we say, to present as African-American women, to say, where are our men? Why aren't there men singing in the chorus here? That took a Well, not a fight, but it took an effort.
This is not the first time you had spoken out. In fact, and I think it's surprising and kind of a wonderful coincidence that on this anniversary of the first sit-ins at Woolworth's in Greensboro, you're sitting across from me because you participated.
Absolutely. The four gentlemen who are so famous right now, one was in my class and three were in my sister's classes in high school. We were all a part of that activity, all that, the marches, the meetings, all of that was a part of my life.
Well, you talked about, we'll bring you back now to 1978. That was the moment that you had been in the main chorus for a while, and then you left. Why?
We were sitting in the auditorium one day, and it was a break, and Maestro Levine was in the pit, and he came where I was sitting, sat next to me, and he said, Elvira, I need you to leave the Met for 5 years. And I said, okay, why? He said, because I want you to leave long enough to get the title the mezzo with the son. I had my son was born by then. He wanted me to get the to stop people from remembering me as the chorus girl. Now, you know, and I know, and everyone else recognizes that when you have an organization of that nature, you plan your programs 5, 6, 7, sometimes 10 years in advance. But the right hand doesn't generally tell the left hand what it's doing. So I didn't think that. I said, okay, and I left. Got my first solo debut with San Francisco Operas. Cornelia did Amneris, did Carmen, did all kinds of wonderful things around the country. And 5 years later, I was called back to the Metropolitan for the Porgy and Bess.
That's interesting. So that you know, he can hear this potential. You can be a solo artist, but the problem is you'll be forever labeled a chorus singer until you actually strike out on your own.
Exactly.
And to give us a sense of what that solo voice is like, we have a little sample of Verdi's Aida, sung by Elvira Green, my guest today on The State of Things. My guest, Elvira Green, singing part of a duet from the opera Aida, that from a 1995 recording. You're striking out on your own as a soloist. Did you feel you were ready at the time?
I have to say that just the idea of finally striking out and walking away to have this opportunity was really exciting. I often say my grandmother never taught her grandchildren how to be afraid. So I didn't know I was supposed to be scared to death, as they say. It was another wonderful adventure, and that's how I accepted all of it.
Tell us about, then, your role as Mariah in Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. How did that come about?
Well, I was in on this tour with my husband in France, touring the different cities in France. Carol Bryce was the Mariah. I had sung off and on time again, Serena, and she came up to me one day after hearing me accompany the rehearsals and sing through some things with my husband. She said, "Why aren't you singing Mariah?" And I thought, okay, she says, "I'm going to teach you how to be a Mariah." So it started there with Carol Bryce working Mariah, because she was the very famous contralto, and that was her signature role. And then we went to the Washington Opera, opened the Melbourne Spoleto Festival, and I went to audition again for Serena. And the conductor came up to me and he said, "We have 1,000 Serenas, but we don't have a Mariah." And that really sealed it for me. And so from that point, even to 2 years ago when I sang with in Fayetteville at the Cape Fear, that is my girl.
I'm talking with opera singer Elvira Green today on The State of Things. The idea of staking out a role for yourself, I guess this is something that maybe people don't know about the world of opera. It's not so much that's a very important thing to do, or can be, that you can on the one hand be a great singer and stay with a company and tour around, or you can find a role and move from company to company in that role. Is that right?
That is correct. And that's what happened with Mariah. Generally, it was putting together a cast and realizing, oh, but we need somebody to sing the trio at the end. Everyone remembers the rap, we call it, the Strutton style, the scene she has with the knife with
Sport. You know, we don't remember. Tell us more about Mariah and who she is and how she fits.
Mariah is the matriarch. She's the person who sort of quietly rules from her kitchen. The Catfish Row. She takes care of Porgy. She makes sure that Bess comes on the scene and behaves herself as much as possible. She runs Sport and Life off from trying to sell Bess the happy dust. And she looks after all the sick, she and Serena. And she really is the backbone. And that, and it's a really big contralto role. But I equate the trio at the end to the trio of Der Rosenkavalier. You can declaim and holler and scream all night long, but if you can't carry that beautiful vocal line in the trio at the end, and many are the times that I have had the privilege to be called at the last minute when companies have realized, oh, they can do the Strutton style, but there's no voice left. Mm. So that's one of the things I try to help young people understand who say they want to sing Mariah and Porgy and Bess. Let's start with the trio and work back and work back.
Is that, do you have to then pace yourself in that role? Do you have to be careful to save something of yourself for the end?
It's called technique again.
Yeah.
And if your technique is solid as a singer, then you can sing for 2.5 hours and then sing the trio at the end. Because at the Metropolitan, Maestro Levine did not miss a page.
So, I mean, it's not a matter. When I use that phrase, save yourself, it troubled me a little bit. I can't imagine a singer in an opera setting saving themselves. You would imagine yourself throwing yourself at it the whole time. But you just explained it. It's being, you know, sort of right the whole time. Because, you know, the Beatles famously saved Twist and Shout for their last number because they couldn't say, you know, sing another note after that.
After that, well, it really is technique.
They were not famous for their technique. Sweet little melodies, but technique is not. Let me ask you quickly, you performed this thing. How many times do you think you performed it?
Pretty close to 2,000.
Wow.
Yes, I've been singing, carrying that girl around the world. Many, many years, many, many performances. Most of the times on our European trip, there were performances 7 days a week, and I did them all. And that was for a 3-year period, and then here, there, and yon.
Wow. Do you have to do anything to really psych yourself up and get yourself back, you know, caring about this role after having performed it so many times?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I constantly revisit the score, read her off the page, relate her to who she is as the matriarch of Catfish Row, to Porgy, because I've had so many different Porgies and so many different Serenas and so many different Besses, and then a company of people. So this is all new, so she has to be willing to approach it from that point.
Elvira Green is my guest on The State of Things. Our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. I'm talking this hour with Elvira Green. She's an artist in residence at North Carolina Central University. Quite a career as an opera singer that includes stints at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, hundreds of other performances all around the world. You came back to North Carolina after doing all that travel in the 1990s. Your husband passed away in the 90s, mm-hmm. and you came back. What did you think? Where were you headed then? What was your vision?
My vision was to come back and work with the young people in North Carolina, in Guilford County, in Greensboro, to instill in them something of how I became a musician and then went into the field of opera. But as I was bringing my boxes back from New York, I got a call from a friend who sang with me at the Metropolitan, as a matter of fact, to ask me if I would be interested in coming to the Caribbean. And I thought, oh, that's the one place I haven't performed. And she said, no, not to perform. We need a vocal program here. Can you come and design a vocal studies program at the University of the Virgin Islands? So after having been home for a while, hadn't finished unpacking my boxes, in 2001, I went to the University of the Virgin Islands to design a vocal studies program for them. In that process, with the wonderful Professor Austin A. Van Zandt, we put together the Broadway Classical Production Company, and I staged The King and I and The Sound of Music, Amahl and the Night Visitors, A Night at the Opera in Broadway, all kinds of wonderful things for those wonderfully talented young people and all that island land down there. So I was there until 2004, which was the beginning of the pre-centennial at North Carolina Central. And I came up to sing a couple of pieces for them. And the chancellor asked me if I had finished my work down there. And I said, yes. He said, because we need you here. Go see the chair of the music department. And so I went to see Dr. Harrell. And what was to have been 1 year as a scholar in residence ended up 11 years later as artist in residence.
I want to hear more about that and the kind of work you're doing now at Central. But take us back again to Greensboro, because you worked with the Greensboro Opera Company and developed mm-hmm. a camp, mm-hmm. right? An opera camp. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
So they had started the opera camp a year before and had tried to use Leontine Price's book that she wrote for children, Aida. They were concerned that it wasn't as successful as they wanted it to be, but they wanted to continue. So they hired a wonderful young gentleman to do the magic flute the second year. And in the preparation of the piece, he had to leave. And I was sitting at the table one morning working crossword puzzles with my mom. And I said, oh, what is this about? Greensboro Opera has a summer opera camp. I called the number, and to just segue to the fast part of that, sat in a meeting. The ladies were going through their what ifs and this and that and the other. And I raised my hand and asked several questions. And the next thing I knew, I was the music director for the summer opera camp. So every summer from 90, was it 95, I think, until 2000 and something. Again, I'm not really.
Mid-90s to the early.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I was the music director with a colleague of mine from the Met who came to help me stage, and we just had an incredibly wonderful time. And then the Greensboro Opera Company decided, for whatever reasons, that they would take that off of their timeline, as it were. And I thought, well, here we are with 50 plus children every summer looking forward to 3 weeks. What do we do about it? So I put together the Singers Studio summer opera program for preteen and young teens. And that program worked really well.
Well, tell us the technique. I love the approach that you take mm-hmm. with kids in developing opera, because, you know, we can guess that not a lot of kids these days are exposed to opera. Mm-hmm. So if you have that number of students at that age, this may be their first exposure. Tell us how you do it.
Well, that first day they come in to read a story. They are all given the complete works, and line by line, they read the stories. That's the morning. They go out for lunch. They come back. They continue to read the story. And then they realize, when we open to the first page of the music, that they have been listening to the music all morning. So at the end of the day, we know what the story is. We've already learned the first song. And they write at the end of each day what that first day was. That program lasts 3 weeks, at which point they not only work on the music, they work on their costumes, they work on the staging, and present in 3.5 weeks. It's really scaled down, but they get a chance to perform in operas just as I did at the Met. So when Greensboro Opera, for instance, did Tosca, those were the summer opera camp children. When they did Carmen, the street urchins were the summer opera kids. And now I see young people who were in back there, their attorneys, their nurses, their doctors, their company managers, and they all see me and they said, "Oh, Miss Green, oh, Miss Green, oh, I remember my summer opera camp." So that's why all my adult life I have been an advocate for young people in the arts, because they will do it if we invite right. them.
Well, and find the way in, and the idea mm-hmm. that you take them into the story first. I mean, it's a camp, so it was somebody's idea to put them there. Now, it could have been their parents, but mm-hmm. I wonder how much resistance there is initially from the kids. And if not resistance, you know, just sort of not understanding exactly what opera, misunderstanding about what opera is, and how much of that, you know, sort of goes away at the end of 3 weeks.
Well, if I have a moment, I want to just relate a quick little story. This young boy came, sat the entire morning, and at lunchtime, I looked at him and I said, "Danny, you're not participating." He said, "But what am I doing here?" I said, "This is an opera camp. Is this what my mother brought me to?" Well, as it happened, the television station came one day, and because every child learns everything, and the young man who had been given the lead role was not there, and Danny did the lead role. Well, then he was no longer going to be a football player. He was going to sing opera. Well, Danny graduated from North Carolina Central 4 years ago in the top of his law class. So he now has his law firm.
You don't all have to get a job at the Met right. in order to have this payoff. But it seems to me, too, again, the importance of studying anything, of mm-hmm. music in particular, or mm-hmm. music in general, but opera in particular, mm-hmm. there are a lot of parts and there are a lot of ways in. I mean, these stories are very accessible. There's a reason we call daytime television soap operas. There
exactly.
are stories that we all get. Mm-hmm. They're visceral, they're emotional, mm-hmm. and the music is that way. Mm-hmm. It moves us. And it's so to understand how the parts come together is the challenge and puzzle for kids. And I would guess that they light right up when they see that this is how the, you know, a bill becomes law. Mm-hmm. And I can understand this.
Exactly. Right? But the work comes in first. You have to have your languages. You have to have your teacher. You have to have your coach. You have to take care of your body. Mm-hmm. If you're not conscious of your body and the health respectful place it has to be. The voice doesn't matter. The voice isn't going to work if the body is not healthy. This is one of the most difficult things to have young people to understand. You cannot go screaming and hollering. You can't stay up late every night. You can't imbibe everything you think you want to do. You can't go to the everybody's party. You have to treat yourself as someone who loves your body. We are, in our industry, Olympians. We have to.
So paying attention to your body. I was thinking, on the one hand, you might be talking me out of it if you're telling me I can't go to parties. But the idea that the body is your temple and that mm-hmm. this. And I think, you know, for people who then go through programs like this and excel in other fields, again, it's not surprising mm-hmm. when you think of yourself holistically.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And as the products that you're consuming, as something other people constructed, it gives you a sense of power and agency. Oh, I don't have to just look at the screen and take it all in. Mm-hmm. I can make some of this stuff, right?
It's true.
Well, you also are very interested in teaching the art of the Negro spiritual.
Absolutely.
Tell us how you came to be engaged in this and sort of what sparked your interest in the first place.
Well, it is part of who we are. I grew up in a church where we sang anthems and hymns and Negro spirituals. I worked all of my adult life with Sylvia Olden Lee, who was a major component of understanding why the spirituals belong to us, understanding the difference between what a Negro spiritual is, what an African-American art song is, and what a gospel song is, where the spirituals came from. And there's that whole history thing, which anybody can look up and read. But many times one has to take a moment to make the difference in understanding what the Negro spiritual is as opposed to what the gospel song is.
I want to give us a sample right now. This is you singing a spiritual city called Heaven. We'll have an example of a spiritual. Then I want to come back mm-hmm. and have you distinguish for us between gospel and spiritual. Let's listen.
My brothers and sisters won't own me because I am trying to get.
My guest is Elvira Green, mezzo-soprano, singing City Called Heaven. That performance recorded at the Marian Anderson Memorial Concert in San Francisco in 1995. A beautiful song, and you can hear also not only the emotion, but the emotion it evoked in your audience. They were responding directly to the power of that song. How is a song like that, how is the spiritual distinct from gospel music?
The spiritual, of course, emanated from the fact that the enslaved needed not only a language that they could each understand, since they were brought here from different parts of the African continent, but they loved the spirit of music. As I learned during my visits to the African continent, it's what they call life. They don't even call it music. So they use this to give them hope, to inspire them, to do this, keep going, keep moving, and yet to send messages, because they knew that one day would come that they would have to find a way out of that environment. So they used the language as they garnered from hearing their masters and singing in churches, because that was the only time that they were not being watched. So the spiritual grew out of that human experience, that this is what we are feeling, or these are the messages that we have to send. The gospel song comes also from a feeling, but it comes out of I would say, a hymn book kind of thing, where you have maybe a 5-verse hymn, and it starts with, yes, God is real, and then it goes on. But for the first 20 minutes of the song, you hear over and over again versions of that. It did not come from the same place the spiritual came. It actually was part of the Caucasian existence on this in America.
Much more rooted in Christianity,
exactly,
in particular, rather than kind of a appeal to the divine and human experience.
Exactly. Exactly.
For you as a singer and a trained opera singer, when you sing a spiritual, do you find yourself in a different mode when you prepare for that song? How is it different and how is it the same for you to sing a spiritual?
Words always are important to me. And the thing I have to do as a singer is to be able to sing it and not let my emotions get the best of me. So as a trained singer, that's another component of learning to put all that together, to share with your audience. Your audience don't want to see you up there sobbing. They want to feel what you are giving them. So you have to somehow have a distance between, I could cry every time I sing this spiritual, and I have to present this to the audience, and they will respond.
That's probably how it becomes bigger than life, as I hear you say that. The idea that that is, in a way, so professionally managed and contained, it gives it, in a sense, more power,
mm-hmm.
because it's not leaking out of you.
Exactly.
I may say. But you haven't lost it. You haven't run away from the emotion, because that's another way to escape it, and then your audience wouldn't feel it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Amazing stuff. Well, so I don't have much time left. You're going to be leaving Central. This is your last year there.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a studio in Greensboro.
Yes, and I plan to reopen that. I have people waiting. Miss Green, when are you coming so I can start my lessons again? It's piano and voice and coaching of classical literature, Broadway music, and of course the art of the Negro spiritual.
Fantastic stuff. What a great pleasure to talk with you, Elvira Green. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
It's my joy. Thank you so much.
Elvira Green is artist in residence at North Carolina Central University, served the Metropolitan Opera in New York off and on from 1966 to 91. You can find out more about Elvira Green and everything we talk about on the State of Things at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.